Now, correspondences are such astonishing things to study that I hope during the course of the lecture to introduce you to a new way of regarding not only the Bible, but something about the Quran, to gain a new insight into archaeological artifacts, and even into fairy tales. Correspondences come into all of these. Some psychologists have attempted to analyse both the Bible and the Quran in psychological terms, which is useful and valuable, but their analyses don't go far enough.
We have to try and see what Swedenborg has given us in depth, because in my opinion, and it's only my personal opinion, he has penetrated to extraordinary spiritual and celestial depths that we don't find among the psychologists. Correspondences are very easy to understand if we examine human behavior. When we watch people, they've got a body language whereby they're expressing internal states in an unconscious manner. People are giving themselves away all the time. Now, you people are in a fortunate position. You can see all my little gestures, you can see my mannerisms, and so you should be able to read me through and through. But this is what body language does. If we watch the way that people behave, we find that they are giving little subtle expressions of internal emotional states, and also some of their thought patterns come out. The frown, the embarrassed blush, the various fidgety movements. Some people are very fidgety. They're tugging ears or pulling their nose or scratching some patch on the back of the head. All of these little things are indications of either internal tensions or unresolved emotions. And these outward expressions that we see, they correspond to the internal states of the person. Correspondences live with us. They're not simply theoretical, abstract ideas. They are living processes. And if we can establish this principle firmly in our minds to begin with, I think you'll find that everything else that follows will make a lot more sense. We must learn to study our own gestures. We must try to catch ourselves out, as it were, as much as possible, to see what we're giving away from inside of ourselves. We can't help ourselves because our inner life is constantly trying to make itself known. Many people endeavor to repress or hold in check their inner states. It's impossible, because even if they remain quite still or hold their hands very tightly and refuse to move very much, it's the tone of voice, the expression of the face, the way the eyebrows move. All of these are correspondential expressions of what is within the individual. Now, how are we going to make use of this? In what way did Swedenborg make use of it? Swedenborg didn't invent correspondences. Correspondences are as old as time itself. As long as human beings have been on this earth, there has been correspondential activity, and people have understood things in the language of correspondences. In modern times, we have forgotten it very largely. Swedenborg looked towards the Lord God as the fundamental source of life, and saw that there was an endless outpouring from the divine of an enormous amount of knowledge, wisdom, love, creativity, functional uses, and so on. And because his spiritual senses were opened, he was able to see how high spiritual and celestial states passed into external physical things and patterns and shapes and manifestations, and saw that there was a harmony and an agreement between the high causative principles and the ultimate end effects. You see, the whole essence of correspondence is agreement and harmony. The outward expression must always agree with the inward cause. If we fix this idea in our minds also, we've got the second great principle of correspondences established for ourselves. To appreciate this, we must look at the cosmic view that Swedenborg had. He saw the Lord God as a creative power of such magnitude that infinity is the only word to describe it. And from this infinite, eternal, living, creative, feeling, loving consciousness, there was brought forth a universe, not just this universe that we see, but several levels, if you like, several universes which were very closely juxtaposed. To illustrate the idea, let's draw a very simple diagram to show you what he was talking about. We have the divine, the creative source. The divine pours from itself such a plenitude of feelings, states, consciousness, indeed all the things that we cannot possibly summarize in words, but just everything that makes creation possible, generates a series of degrees or worlds. The first one is referred to as the celestial. The second is the spiritual. And last of all is the natural. Now it's from the divine substance itself. God is not just an ethereal something or other floating around in who knows where. The divine is absolute substance itself. And from that substance, the divine generates, first of all, a celestial world composed of ultrafine stuff. Ultrafine substance that is tremendously receptive to the divine outpouring. But it's highly mobile, it's so enormously mobile that it's full of change and activity and transformation. And that isn't enough to produce what God is seeking. God has, if you like, in mind a very great purpose, a tremendous cosmic purpose. The universe doesn't come into existence just for the fun of throwing around a little bit of energy. There is an ongoing purpose and we're part of it. So the divine has in mind a certain purpose, and from the celestial, because the energy is so mobile and nothing can be firmly crystallized yet, another world of still denser material is formed, which becomes the spiritual. The spiritual world is in many respects quite different from the celestial. It's of course of material. The functions and activities there are different. The degrees of knowledge and understanding are different again. It too is still a very mobile world. The divine creative energies have not yet come into a restful state where external stable manifestations can occur. And so there is a final outpouring until all the dense things of matter, the world that we see around us, is formed. So there is a tremendous outpouring through level after level of increasing density, and the further we come down the scale, the less becomes the understanding, the dimmer becomes the view that living beings have of their environment. It's like diving down into the depths of the ocean. If you go down, shall we say, 100 meters with scuba gear, unless the water is miraculously clear, you can't see very far. Close by the surface, you can see much farther. When you come out, you can see a very, very broad landscape. And that's how it is in the universe. Our view at this level is very obscure. At the spiritual level, it is very much clearer. At the celestial level, it's extraordinarily clear. These worlds, although they are separate and have quite different laws, processes, and qualities, are nevertheless connected together, because the things that we find in the natural world, they correspond to things in the spiritual world, and things in the spiritual world correspond to things in the celestial world, and things in the celestial world correspond to everything in the divine. The worlds are interconnected by correspondences. Correspondences conjoin what would otherwise be a series of separate steps or levels. Correspondences, therefore, according to Swedenborg, enter into the very structure of reality itself. Now, this is an enormous cosmic view. So we begin to see now that correspondences, as we said a little earlier, are not simply abstract intellectual connections between things that we mentally work out. According to Swedenborg, this is the very way in which the universe is put together. It also means that whatever the divine transmits into the universe, whatever is transmitted by the way of divine outpourings at the celestial level, beings at the celestial level, souls or spirits, angels, whatever you like to call them, they receive from that outpouring what they are capable of assimilating into themselves, which is very, very considerable. The same outpouring will lead into the spiritual world where there is a lesser receptivity because of the lesser degree of development of those people. And at the natural, there is a still lesser receptivity, even though it is the same divine outpouring. So people at one level will see things fairly crudely, externally, densely. At a spiritual level, they'll see things much more clearly and hear the full radiance of everything that is transmitted, is assimilated and lived. So the idea that these lower things which we see and experience correspond to things that we do not see is a very vital idea. On this score we have a quotation from Swedenborg which explains this very nicely when he says, "Whatever exists in the natural world derives its origin and cause from things which exist in the spiritual world. Since universal nature is nothing else than a theatre representative of the Lord's kingdom, hence arise correspondences." So the natural world is the reflection of everything in these higher worlds. If we can understand the language of correspondences, our study of all the visible things around us will give us clues as to processes, functions and qualities in these higher worlds, and so there comes the possible opening up of our spiritual functions and capacities. Now let us try to see an example of correspondence at work. We all see the physical sun many times in the course of our life. We're quite familiar with the physical sun. Swedenborg, through his, if you like, out of the body or transcendental experiences, also saw what he called the spiritual sun. In some oriental teachings it's referred to the holy sun absolute, but it means the same thing, and that is the divine is seen from the celestial world as an enormous blazing sun of incredible brilliance. This is also spoken of in the Bhagavad Gita, one of the Indian Bibles or Indian texts, where Arjuna has his inner senses opened and he sees this enormous blazing sun, and he said it's like 1,000 suns blazing in the sky. So we have from various sources exactly the same description, that the divine effulgence is so intense that it's like an enormous blazing sun with a tremendous intensity of light. So we have this idea of the spiritual sun through which the emanations of the divine proceed in all directions. We also have our own physical sun in this part of the galaxy. There are also myriads of other suns in our Milky Way.
Swedenborg tells us that the natural sun corresponds to the spiritual sun. We know that the physical sun is a thermonuclear device. Swedenborg, living those centuries ago, had no knowledge of thermonuclear physics or any of that kind of knowledge, but we know today that it's a mass of hydrogen that is being converted into helium, and the helium is converted into carbon, nitrogen, and there is a marvelous birth of chemical elements taking place in the sun. Because it's nuclear energy, it's very hot and it's radiant. The internal temperature of the sun is around about 20 million degrees Celsius. Really good for cooking. He called it pure fire. Well, that's as good a description as anything, but it's not a fire of burning in which oxygen is involved. It is a nuclear reaction. Swedenborg also says that everything that comes from the sun is nature itself. Nature comes from and exists under the sun. So wherever there are suns, you're going to have natural phenomena and natural surroundings. Everything depends upon the spiritual sun for the existence of all of these other stars. Let's just deal with the physical sun for a minute or two. The universe is filled with hydrogen. By gravitation, the hydrogen is gradually pulled into these protosuns. Protosuns gradually condense under gravitational pressure until they start to glow, and then the nuclear reactions start. Helium is changed into heavier and heavier chemical elements. In some very large and extremely hot suns with an internal temperature of 100 million degrees Celsius, a lot of chemical elements like iron and so on are produced. Some of these suns turn into supernovae. They glow very brightly, and then they simply burst, they explode. And they throw these chemical elements into space, which drift around for a long time. Eventually, through localized gravitational attractions, those chemical substances enter into the composition of planets, into moons, into asteroids, and all manner of things. But there is, from this birth of chemical elements, an eventual formation of suns and moons and stars. In other words, nature is born. And so when Swedenborg says the natural sun is the progenitor of nature, he was describing in general principles what today we know in a fair amount of detail. But as this spiritual sun, just how are these things connected? To see a very good example of correspondences at work, let us now draw upon an ancient Egyptian hieroglyph which shows this relationship very clearly. The Egyptians were very familiar with the language of correspondences. And all of the hieroglyphs, as Swedenborg rightly points out, are themselves pure correspondences. Now, in this particular diagram, which has been repeated in many, many books, and is one that perhaps most of you are familiar with, we have this excellent relationship. We have a sun up here, and we have a whole series of sun's rays coming down. I'm not going to take waste your time by drawing in all these droplets of energy coming down from the sun. A physicist would say, quanta of energy. And he may be absolutely right. Undoubtedly, these are spurts of energy. But they terminate, we'll just draw lines to indicate it's a continuation of those things. At the bottom, there is this hieroglyph, which is a sun coming up over the horizon. Now, that's the natural sun. That's the spiritual sun. We have on each side a pair of figures, bearded figures, and the interesting part is they have bodies of birds. They also have a pair of arms with the hands raised in adoration. And the same thing occurs over here. Here, bird's body, and a pair of legs, and another pair of arms coming up here. And everything's on a pedestal.
These are the twin souls which are adoring both the spiritual sun and the outpourings from the divine. This shows that the energies from the divine are passing into, in fact, the final drop of energy coming down here can be seen merging with the physical sun itself. The physical sun is maintained in its existence by this creative energy, this consciousness, this wisdom, this love, which is perpetually flowing from the divine and is sustaining this. The physical sun corresponds precisely to that spiritual sun, which is the divine itself. That is, all the consciousness, all the essence of the divine appears to the vision of a celestial being as though it were a sun in the sky. This is a very remarkable relationship. It is such a direct, pure correspondence that anyone looking at it for a few minutes will see the connection.
And this is the beauty of correspondences set down in graphic form, in the form of drawings. These diagrams, they explain themselves. If we look very carefully at each part, we can begin to read the correspondence. And it's most important for us to learn to read the correspondences of everything around us. What do the pillars in this room, for example, represent? What do the walls represent? What does the ceiling represent? What does the floor represent? These are universal archetypal symbols. It is the way in which the divine is speaking to us. But somehow we've got ourselves fouled up. We don't even recognize it as a language. Everything is significant. Every door that we pass through, you have a pair of uprights or doorposts, and you have a lintel over the top. This is rich with a whole multitude of meanings. Something. Pillars of truth are supporting that higher quality of love itself. That's what doorways indicate, and you've got doorways everywhere in every building. So to read the diagrams, to read the hieroglyphs, which in three-dimensional form are everywhere around us, is most important. But of course the Egyptian hieroglyphs, having a mysterious quality about them and being ancient, they touch us in a special emotional way. And that's helpful, that's good.
Swedenborg, of course, was tremendously interested in the spiritual content of the word, that is, certain select books of the Old Testament and a great deal of the New Testament. He was interested in finding the inner meanings and hoping those inner meanings would help him to discover the soul. It was the soul that was his great quest in life. And therefore his studies took him into profound depths into both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And the Arcana Celestia and his other theological writings are absolutely rich with correspondences. Every page of Swedenborg that you read will be dealing with correspondences. But it's appreciating what these correspondences are and how they function that is the important thing. He also made mention in his writings that the Quran, that is the Bible of the Muslim religion, likewise contains correspondences, although not as many as in the Old Testament. And he pointed out that there were parables in the Quran as well. When we look at the Quran carefully, we do find these parables. And what is interesting, the parables are described as reminding factors to put people into a state of conscious remembering so they start to remember their relationship to the divine. So the parables which are intentionally set forth there are quite fascinating. But what is even more interesting is the Sufis, who are, if you like, the mystics of Islam. And these are the men and women who strive to discover the inner content of the Quran, what lies behind the written word. Many of them attained extraordinary states of insight and consciousness. And some of them felt this great love that the divine is constantly pouring from itself into the world. And they came up with a scheme which is very interesting, which gives insight into, again, the working of correspondences. According to the Sufis, the divine emanates from itself the whole of creation, but it does so on three levels, but the levels are named differently from the way that Swedenborg names them. This first level is called the world of archetypes, which we'll tell you about in a minute. Then comes a quite different world, the world of symbols. And finally, we have this dense world, the world of nature, the external phenomenal world. According to the Sufi scheme, the archetypes are the self-revelations of God. God discloses himself, makes known some of his qualities, and this is a very sacred, holy, heavenly realm. Included in those qualities are the names of God. Now, those familiar with the Islam religion know that there are 99 beautiful names of God. Names, of course, are representations of the qualities of the divine. And we have such qualities in the Old Testament. Jehovah Nissi, Jehovah of the Banner, the Lord God of Hosts, the Lord, Adonai, Jehovah. All of these are special archetypal patterns that correspond to the actual living qualities of the divine itself. So immediately, the Sufi scheme shows that there is a world that in an indirect way is knowable to us through the names of the divine, and those names correspond precisely to divine qualities. The world of symbols is a spiritual world in which all the potentials of creation begin to unfold themselves. The pattern of what is possible, the whole scheme of the unfolding world begins to display itself in both symbolic form and in actual patterns. But it's called the world of symbols because everything that exists in this potential and developing form corresponds precisely to the divine nature. The Sufis are very specific about this. Whatever they get to know about in this world of symbols, they know is just an indication and must always be referred to the divine so that the inward meaning can be brought forth. They see the natural world as a very remarkable end effect, which should function as a gigantic mirror. For them, the outer world should be a mirror in which the divine, the world of archetypes, and the world of symbols is reflected. And they say it is man's cosmic duty to polish the mirror so that it faithfully reflects all these divine qualities and symbols back to the divine. And also so that we may see in this mirror the nature of the divine creative energy and the divine creative purpose. There are many Sufi teaching stories. One teaching story runs along these lines, that there was a contest held between Greeks and Chinese as to who could produce the most beautiful building. And so the Greeks got busy and they produced a building, and the inside was painted magnificently with all sorts of scenery and symbols, and it was a wonderful sight to behold. But the Chinese put mirrors all around, and they polished the mirrors until the finest details were reflected. And of course, that was faithfully reflecting the whole pattern of creation. And it was the room with the highly polished mirrors that won the great award for that best of all buildings. And that's simply a teaching story about our function in the world, to see the divine mirrored in everything that is around us. The polishing, well, we don't polish the external world. We polish up our consciousness. We polish up our mind so that we are able to see without obscurity what is really there. The numerous symbols that have come from ancient Egypt help us to appreciate the operation of correspondences in ancient times, and so gives us an inroad into our utilization of them in the present era. One of the great correspondential symbols of the ancients was this fabulous bird, the phoenix. Herodotus, the Greek, he loved visiting Egypt, and he was very disappointed to find that the Egyptians would not teach him how to read the hieroglyphs. After all, for the Egyptians, Medu-Netto, which was their name for the hieroglyphs, was a secret. And as far as the Egyptian priests were concerned, the Greeks and others were barbarians. They tolerated them, but they looked upon them as inferior people. Herodotus never got to know the inner aspects of the various symbols and signs that he saw in Egypt. What he didn't get to know, he invented. It was that man who invented the story of the phoenix, this fabulous bird which every 500 years flies away to a certain place, settles onto a funeral pyre, is burned to ashes, and then it's resurrected out of its ashes and goes through the whole process again. That story is not the original Egyptian story. It was something made up by Herodotus. Now, the original teaching story in ancient Egypt was about the Bennu bird. The Bennu bird, and the name is written as follows. That's the B, that's the N, and that's the U or the W. So Bennu is the original name of this heron with the crest on. We read about it in the Book of the Dead. In the Egyptian Book of the Dead, chapter 89, is an entire chapter concerned with being transformed into the Bennu bird. When we read that chapter and some of the coffin texts, we find that the Bennu bird is described as follows. In the beginning there was primordial substance. It was formless, but nevertheless it was a ponderous reality. And then quite miraculously this bird, this Bennu bird, flew up out of the primeval substance and just appeared. And then it made a long, loud cry, and that was the first sound that pierced the eternal silence. As soon as the Bennu bird had made its cry, the cycles of time and energy started. Things began to crystallize. The whole pattern of creation was set underway. And the Egyptians also saw in the rising sun the presence of the Bennu bird, or the phoenix. It's reborn each day. This eternal creative process is repeated day after day. Now, for the Egyptians, the Bennu bird was the absolutely essential symbol of the divine life. Here is the divine appearing in the form of a bird. Its cry, its first cry, is the Logos, the Word. And it's from that Word, it's from that eternal divine Word, that all creation, all knowledge, all wisdom proceeds. You see, to liken the creative act to the flight and the cry of a bird, to us it may seem strange, but in the language of correspondences, it makes perfect sense. The Egyptians didn't worship that bird, but they made many models and images of it to remind themselves of that first creative act. The very divine flying up out of that primordial substance indicates a new freedom, a new movement, setting into motion specific things and processes and functions, whereas before everything lay in a potential state. And so every time the Egyptians saw the rising sun, they tried to remind themselves of this first creative act. And they gave reverence to the creative spirit for having brought forth the remarkable world in which they lived. An even more remarkable Egyptian symbol, and a much more complicated one, is as follows. It'll only take a little while to get this down. We have a beautiful red sun disk. We have a pair of hands almost touching it, coming down through these arms to touch the arms of an ankh, one of those famous Egyptian symbols that people wear around their necks these days. That sits on top of a structure that has four layers, and the whole thing is part of, if you like, a tree trunk. And then in this layer there are some symbols. I'll draw them in quickly. It's a pair of eyes, and between them there is an Egyptian hieroglyph, which we'll talk about in a minute. This structure is known as a Djed column. This is the ankh, and we see that the ankh has a pair of arms that reach up to and almost embrace this sun. Because that sun is a representation of the spiritual sun, which is a representation of the divine itself, we start reading the symbol from the top downwards. The sun is the source of all existence. The sun pours its very energies into the arms of the Ankh, and the Ankh in turn translates this energy into this strange Jed column. So if we get the idea of something flowing down through these different levels, we've got the general idea. But what is the Jed column all about? We know that the Jed column was a symbol of resurrection. Among the Egyptians there was a very famous God-man known as Osiris. Osiris was the divine incarnate, and he was greatly loved. He was virtually a king of Egypt, and he taught mankind how to read, how to write, indeed how to exist, how to plow the fields, how to gather crops, care for animals. He was torn to pieces by his jealous brother Set. Osiris's wife Isis bound the pieces of the body together because they'd been hacked apart, and so formed the first mummy. Osiris became the first resurrected being. And interestingly, in the ancient Egyptian texts, he entered into the spiritual world as the Good Shepherd. Now this is 5,000 years before Christ was born. It's a very interesting foreshadowing of what was to come. The Jed column was a piece of wood. It was a wooden object or fetish, usually about 4 or 5 feet high, and this was used as the symbol of the resurrection of Osiris. Every year in Abydos and other places in Egypt, the whole life and death and resurrection of Osiris was enacted as a mystery play to keep the people conscious of their religious roots and their religious sources. And the Jed column would be pulled out of a coffin at a crucial stage in the ceremony, and everybody would rejoice. The Lord is risen was the great cry that went up. So the Jed column is a representation of resurrection, rebirth. The Ankh, as almost everybody knows, is a symbol of life. The Ankh is often seen in Egyptian inscriptions, especially inside tombs, as being held by deities, like a key in the hand. And that key, or the end of the key, is touched against the lips of the deceased, showing that spiritual life is being transferred into the deceased as a gift from the divine. So the Ankh is a sort of key of life, and only divine figures hold it. The arms, Swedenborg points out to us that in the language of correspondences, hands and arms are representations of power. The power of our mind is expressed through our arms. The arms are extensions of our mind, bringing into active manifestation the thoughts and impulses and creative tendencies that we have in our mind. Think of all the things we do with our hands. Hands and arms are the way in which mind becomes expressed externally. But the arms are also the power to receive, because we're capable of holding our hands and arms in a receptive gesture. So to have the power to receive is very important. And this is what this representation is all about. From the divine, which is represented by that sun, there is the outpouring of life itself. And life is pure love and pure wisdom. The arms, which reach up, they have the power to receive this life, that is, this pure love, this pure wisdom. They receive it, and what is received is experienced as the very energy of life, symbolized by the Ankh, which then passes into the interiors of a person to renew, to regenerate their spirit. During the course of a lifetime, to virtually resurrect a sleeping, dormant, undeveloped spirit into a state of full consciousness and wakefulness. That's the rebirth that is taught in Christianity. It must be an actual process. On the Jed column we have these two symbols. The right eye signifies the sun, the left eye signifies the moon. This represents all the light and the warmth of love itself. The moon is the representation of faith in the divine, a faith that binds and connects in a meaningful way. And this symbol, which is written Nefer, it means good. That is the actual translation of the Egyptian word nefer. So we see on this symbol of resurrection that through the life that is transmitted from the divine, which is consciously received and relayed into the whole of one's being in an intentional manner, in a delightful and accepting manner, and is made one's own, it illuminates the higher part of ourself to receive and to live more strongly by the love, the heat, and the light that comes from the divine, and by that inwardness of faith. And because they go together and they are linked together, out of that emerges the fundamental good of existence. The good of the divine becomes manifested in the individual according to the state of receptivity. Now here we're only just touching on the surface of these correspondences. One could write a whole book just on this symbol alone. So much information is condensed and packed into this that we can only briefly deal with it in passing to show that there is a whole language of meaning and very, very important meanings in such a complex assembly. Let's turn now to another culture altogether. Among the ancients, the Babylonians, or some of them, were also well informed regarding the science of correspondences. And whilst they produced many symbols, some of them were extraordinarily striking. And the one that we're going to look at now is known as Alamosu. Now, Alamosu is really a fabulous being. We have a human head with a large headdress on. This merges into a very dramatic looking body. Indeed, it becomes the body of a lion. And there is something strange about this lion, because at the front it has three legs. It's a very strange arrangement indeed. At the tail end it just has two legs. I'm going to be mean. I'm not going to tell you the meanings of the five legs. You're going to think this out for yourselves, because you've got to participate. There is, of course, a tail. Then we have a magnificent pair of wings with all these wonderful feathers on. In addition, we have on the head three pairs of horns. So we've got altogether 6 points. Three on this side, three on the other side. So we have the body of a lion, and it has these five legs, it has the face of a man, and it has huge wings on it, and horns on the headdress. This is a very strange combination indeed. But this is how the language and the science of correspondences was employed, to gather together symbols from quite different beings and structures and to bring them together. Whereas one single hieroglyph like this just spills out a single word and a single meaning, when you bring a whole lot of quite different forms together in this composite pattern, you've got a sentence, more than a sentence. You've got paragraphs, you've got pages, you've got virtually a book written into that with a lot of hidden internal meanings. Now let's try to figure out something of this. We know from Eastern studies that horns on a headdress are an indication of the degree of inner spiritual development of a person. In ancient times, people even painted on the walls of caves human figures bearing antlers on their head, and the number of points on the antlers was a measure of how well developed or awakened they were in the spiritual sense. Now we know this from esoteric schools in the East. Swedenborg tells us also that horns are a symbol of the power of truth. And obviously the greater one's perception of truth, the greater is the power of truth, so the number of horns will be multiplied accordingly. So we can appreciate the horns as an expression of perception of truth and the power of truth, and therefore some inner degree of awakening or development. The human face itself corresponds to the love of seeking truth and wisdom. It is the prerogative of mankind to always search for knowledge, whether it's physical knowledge or scientific knowledge, or whether it's theoretical knowledge, such as mathematical equations about abstract notions. Human beings are seekers of knowledge, and this is what helps to raise us above the animal level. We are always hungry for knowledge, information, and understanding. And so the face represents that quest for, that love for truth. The body of the lion indicates love. It is divine love in its powerful form, and the truth, the power of truth that comes from that love. God is sometimes represented as a lion. We find this in the Old Testament in many places. And so, taking this in a positive sense, we have the body of the lion representing the power of love and the power of truth. Strong and powerful wings are spiritual things which surround and protect celestial things. Now, since the lion's body represents love, that is celestial, that stands at a much higher level than the purely spiritual. The spiritual is like a clothing. It's a type of garment that surrounds and protects the inmost celestial things. The legs, in general, represent the conjunction between love that is at a higher level and love that is at a lower level. It's the connection between spiritual love and natural love. Also, it's a representation of our external understanding. These are correspondences that Swedenborg makes quite clear in his writings. But remember, the five of them, you've got to work out what the five of them represents. I hate to tease you, but it's nice to think sometimes. All right, now we've looked very briefly at the face representing the love of truth and wisdom, at the lion's body representing the power of love and the truth that comes from it. The legs represent the conjunction of inner good and outer good, and also relates to our external understanding. And the wings are spiritual things which clothe and protect celestial things, and also they carry the general idea of flight, movement to another level. Let's put all of those things together and try to understand just a little of what this composite Lamassu is telling us. It's trying hard to tell us something. This is really an instruction about how we ought to work on ourselves. If only we'll take ourselves in hand, and in the light of a genuine spiritual doctrine, which we have thought over, pondered over, which we've learned to accept and we have strong feelings for. Once we've built that into ourselves, then we must work to make that become manifest in our lives with the strength of a lion, with the wisdom and yearning to know and understand the truth as fully and as completely as possible, and with the aspirations towards a new level of being. We must struggle towards greater heights, not just for the sake of putting great big wonderful ego up there, but for the sake of trying to fulfill the love and the good implanted into us, because we see it is good and it's true to manifest those things and develop those things as fully as possible. That's our cosmic duty. So how many people will work like a Trojan horse, or with the intensity of a lion's strength, on themselves to develop themselves? People go the opposite way. Everybody goes into yoga. Everybody sits down quietly. They go into a trance. They get into yogic asanas, stand on their heads with their legs crossed. Everything's peaceful. There's no struggle. That's the armchair way of development. I'm not saying that yoga is useless. There are over 50 forms of yoga, but only some of them are really useful. We can make yoga an excellent thing for calmness of mind and for developing certain potentials within ourselves. But far too many people make the way of meditation the be-all of their lives, and it's too much of the calming of the inner God of their own self-love to put themselves into a quiescent state and say, well, I'm quiet inside, I am at one with the divine. It does not work that way. The ancients knew that effort and strength were needed to concentrate one's attention on really trying to throw out the negativities inside. It's a funny thing about a lot of these self-development procedures. All the lovely positive things are stressed. Just think this way and do this exercise that particular way and beautiful things will happen to you. But hardly ever do you hear these instructors saying, first of all, get rid of the rubbish. You've made yourself a rubbish can. Take the lid off, tip the rubbish out, clean it up inside, then you'll have some space for real things to enter. Nobody ever teaches that sort of thing, and yet that's primary. Think of what Christ said to the people around him. Cleanse ye first the inside of the cup and the platter. You've got to clean up the inside before you can make room for something to enter there. And hence the lion's strength. Because there is the strength and power of love and the strength of truth, we've got to be ruthlessly honest with ourselves. We've got to see, in a sense, our nothingness. And that's a very, very hard thing to do, because everybody wants to be something. Everybody wants to be not necessarily important and famous, but everybody wants to attain something in life. And so our feeling of self is very precious to us. But to work against our self-esteem and our self-love with great strength, to have aspirations to reach another level because they are wiser, better, purer, and more sincere levels, that's important. And because we are human, we've got that love within ourselves that can lead us to do these things. Now again, these are only a few of the suggestions that come out of some of the representations of ancient times. This is how the ancients looked at their correspondences. They made all these models. And this is quite a large thing. It stands about 8 or 10 feet high, carved out of brick. And it was a reminder to people to keep on working upon oneself with very, very great intensity. And so we must challenge ourselves to try and do this. If we're going to live, for goodness sake, let's go the whole hog and do it properly. But the correspondences that Swedenborg was seeking were in the word itself, the written word, in those special books of the Bible that carry the internal sense. It takes years for the sincere student to really work through everything that Swedenborg wrote about the correspondences contained in the word. And so just one or two things we shall look at to show how his system of spiritual correspondences brought new meaning into stories and accounts that we're familiar with. Everybody knows about the Exodus, how Moses led the Israelites out of Egypt. They passed through the Red Sea, apparently in a miraculous way, and then they got into desert regions. And this is where this particular story starts. They found themselves in the desert, and after 3 days, the people began to complain. There is no water. And so they went on to another place called Marah. When they came to Marah, there was water there. But the trouble is, it was bitter water. Because the water was bitter, they couldn't drink it. And they complained very, very bitterly to Moses. So Moses cried out to God for help. And God made it known to Moses that he must take wood from a certain tree and throw it into the bitter water, and that would make the bitter water become sweet. And that's what happened. Moses threw the wood into the water became sweet, and the people could drink. Now, of course, on the surface, taken superficially and literally, this sounds like a piece of magic. A scientist will say, ha-ha, let's find out what species of tree it was. Obviously, the wood is rich in sugar, and if you throw plenty of the wood in, it'll sweeten the water up. See, that's the external, literal way of thinking about things. But it has nothing to do with chemistry, biology, transformations of salt water into fresh water. This has to do with the inner life of man. First of all, what are the correspondences? The Israelites are a very special spiritual core reflected in each and every one of us. It is our own spirituality which needs to be led out of its external connections and bondage, which is represented by Egypt, into a higher state, which is represented by the promised land, that land of milk and honey. Something in us has to be cleansed, aroused, and perfected, but as yet it is incomplete. So Moses is leading the Israelites out of this identification with and bondage to the external mind, the external life, which is Egypt. But they come to a wilderness, this desert place. The wilderness itself represents a state of temptation in which we have to struggle against our own identifications, our negativities, our weaknesses. And this is always a very trying time. And the people find that they are without water. The water here represents truth. Truth that they can assimilate to get the know-how, to get that spiritual doctrine, to know how to act. At first there is no water, there is no influx of instruction, illumination. And finally they came to this place, Marah, but there's only bitter water and they can't drink it. What do the bitter waters represent? Since waters are truth, the bitter waters are truths that are too painful. They're too cutting and biting to accept. Nobody wants to hear the bitter truth about themselves, and that's what these bitter waters are. It's always the bitter truth about us, that we're not as great and as wonderful as we seem to be. We are somehow incomplete, undeveloped, inadequate. Now that's a very, very hard thing to accept. It is bitter. And so whilst truths are being provided, these people or this function within us cannot accept it. It rejects it. But then wood is thrown in the water. The wood here represents good. Truth is one thing, good is another. Good is of love. It has a mercy, it has a softness, a gentleness, a forgiveness about it. It reaches into the feeling life, it reaches into the will, whereas truth reaches the mind. It illuminates and makes clear, but it's very cutting, it's very exact. It has to be precise. And it's almost cruel in its correctness about things. Hence the bitter waters. But throwing the wood into the water, that brings love and good to bear upon those people and this function within ourselves. The presence of good and love in our life, in our will, it does something very important. It changes our attitude. Now the people could not drink the bitter waters because they had a certain attitude. They couldn't accept the truth about themselves. When good acts upon that attitude, a new attitude comes altogether. And the people can then learn to accept the truth about themselves. They take a new view of themselves and they accept what was previously too hard a truth to accept. A typical example of this is people who go through life with a chip on their shoulder, always expecting that the world must change to suit their needs. This gradually leads to violence. When we expect the world to change to suit our own wishes and wants and needs, people become violent. If they get into politics, they sometimes pass very hard, harsh laws that don't suit most people, but which suits their political philosophy. If a dictator gets in power, he uses the strength of the army to enforce the kind of social patterning he wants because it suits him but it doesn't suit the other people. This violence, this trying to shape the world to suit our needs, is a very dangerous and self-destructive attitude. And that's why the people found the waters bitter. They couldn't come to acknowledge that their own attitudes were wrong. But it's receiving love in the form of that symbol of the wood that changes everything. Their hard attitude changed. a new attitude developed, and so they could accept truth. When we learn to accept the world as it is, not want to change it, but accept the world as it is, see the riches it contains, the enormous variety of things, and to see that everything is full of symbols and correspondences that's instructing and enlightening and stimulating us all the time. That is a new attitude. Then we accept people and things in such a new and an exciting way. And so the bitter waters become sweet. So we find that in that account, that short account that only covers a couple of verses, there is a whole psychology of self-transformation. We have to change our psyche if we're going to grow. We cannot hang on to our old attitudes and expect to reach those pearly gates and say, look, I've done my very best, here I am, a full-blown individual. I'm entitled to enter into heaven. Many people have that attitude, but it doesn't work that way. It cannot work that way. Self-cleansing, learning to accept realities without trying to change them to suit ourselves. Do you know, even today there are some scientists who will fudge their experimental results to get the sort of result they're looking for. It was only a couple of years ago, a young man in England got a Doctor of Philosophy degree in chemistry on falsified results. The university wanted to take his diploma away from him, but he said, no, you've given it to me now and I'm hanging on to it. And he admitted falsifying his results. You see, to change the world to suit oneself is a very desperate thing. It's an evil thing. And unfortunately, there is such a lot of it that is in the community. It's this sort of thing that makes a minor flood. Let's have a look at something else. The wonderful story of the Tower of Babel is again well known to most people, but we don't always look into its ramifications and significations. And we're told that people went to the Valley of Shinar. Now here we have a valley, a low-lying place, and they said, let us build a city and let's build a tower and let the tower reach into heaven itself. And so you have the idea of a city being built and this incredible tower going up that virtually reaches into heaven. And of course, the story goes that the tower was broken down, the people were scattered, and no longer did they have the one lip and the one tongue. They didn't understand one another anymore. They were scattered. And of course, people say, well, that's how all the different languages in the world arose. We were all scattered, and we had to speak different languages because that was God's punishment for making such a tower. That's literal external interpretation. There is a deeper signification that is important. Here, a city indicates a doctrine, and a tower represents self-love. This is very surprising. But when people have a strong self-love, it seems to them that they do tower above other people. To them it seems that they know more than other people, they are better than other people, they are taller, they stand head and shoulders above all the rest of we ninnies. That's the attitude that a full-blown egotist takes. Self-love is a very strange disease. It falsifies our perception of things. Everything gets out of proportion. And so the Tower of Babel is something that may grow in us if we're not very careful. It can also affect communities. It starts off in a valley. Now, a valley is a much lower state than a plain or a hill. And so we're dealing here with natural, external, sensuous states. People who can only live and think externally, they can only interpret things literally. And everything has to be in black and white terms. And when people live in that external way, somehow they try to use all the things and the finances and other objects and possessions in the world to boost their feeling of egotism, their own presence. And so the tower goes up. But sooner or later, contradictions arise. Supposing now that the tower is built by a group of people, let's just say that some people begin to build this tower that's going to reach into heaven. This actually happens in history. The building of such a tower is the building of a culture. And some people feel that as their culture mellows and develops and more technological knowledge accumulates, that people can actually build a bridge from the earth to heaven itself. They believe that sheer knowledge will eventually enable them to know all the secrets of creation, all the secrets of the universe. And so for a while, people work hard together, they build up their science, their technology, their philosophy, their religiosity and so on, which is a false religiosity. But then as the tower goes higher and higher, these people cease to understand one another, because each person feels that he or she knows best how that building should be continued. And so they all start getting different ideas of how the thing should be perfected and completed. And the more they diversify away from each other, the less they understand each other. Until eventually, with no common bond, no affection to hold them together, their joint efforts fall apart and the whole thing falls into ruin. And at that point, a specific culture historically actually ceases. Toynbee points out that there have been about 21 or 22 major civilizations on the face of this earth, and they've all crumbled and collapsed and fallen away. And he was looking at these cultures from a religious viewpoint, and he indicated there was a sort of inner rot set in during the maturing stages of those cultures. It's the Tower of Babel on a very, very large scale. Let us suppose we look at the Tower of Babel as a personal thing within ourselves. Some people will read books on spiritual development, various esoteric works, oriental works, and they think, I've got all the secrets, all the know-how of perfecting myself. I'm going to build a spiritual body, a Kesjan body, that will soar to the great heights of heaven. And so they'll carry out the exercises, they'll do their meditations, they'll fast, and go through all sorts of difficulties. And they really believe that they are building and building and building a better and a higher and a more wonderful self all the time. But because there is no true self-examination or true self-cleansing, they fail to see that inside them there are all sorts of drives that lead in different directions, different wishes, wants, cravings and passions. And they don't know how to unify those things. It's just like all these different people with different ideas as to how best to build the tower. Inside a person, these unresolved conflicts are taking them in a multitude of directions. And so they begin to fall apart from the inside. This tower of perfection that they are building, it too falls apart in disorder and chaos. And there are many accounts of people who've worked very hard in the way of self-development for years. And when they're on their deathbed, many of them say, I'm confused, I don't know where I'm going, I don't know what I've attained. And that is a very, very sad experience. Curiously, within fairy tales and myths, there are correspondences of great value. If we just briefly consider some of the stories that we've read as children or heard recited, we have tales of flying horses, we have enchanted castles, we have magic rings on the finger that bring about all sorts of transformations, we have wondrous lamps, we have caves filled with treasure. All of these are correspondences, because they were not originally set down as fairy tales for children. They were adult teaching stories in which genuine wisdom relating to our inner life and our inner self were communicated. Some of them are tremendously old. We find them in Egyptian writings. We find them in very ancient Persian writings, going back to a time when the Persians wrote in cuneiform. A very familiar and well-known story is that of Aladdin and his lamp. Aladdin goes down into a cave that is filled with treasures, and it has lots of trees in with marvelous fruits, and the fruits are huge precious stones. And he gets hold of the lamp, and he finds, perhaps accidentally, according to some accounts, that by rubbing the lamp, this great genie comes out who serves him, brings him food, brings him treasures, gives him protection, moves him round from place to place. All right, let's see this in a positive sense, because all of these correspondences have a positive connotation as well as having a negative connotation, but we'll deal with this in a positive sense. Aladdin, and the word itself has to do with religion, interestingly, when we look deeply enough into it. Aladdin is somebody who is, he's only young, he's got a certain innocence in him, and therefore through that innocence something can reach him. He goes down into this underground cavern. A cave or a cavern can represent the immense depths of the unconscious mind. In the unknown unconscious, all manner of things are present. The treasure itself sometimes can represent truths and goods which the divine plants into us without our realizing that they are there. Hence they're in the unconscious part of us. Aladdin in his innocence gets into this inner realm where all these treasures are, but it is the lamp that's the important thing he's been sent to find. A lamp corresponds to spiritual light, spiritual truth. Now by rubbing the lamp, this is a very important thing. It's the crux of the whole thing. To rub a lamp you need a bit of elbow grease, effort. The effort of rubbing the lamp is that struggle everybody must take to polish up their interiors, to work on the soul, on the self, to try and see what our negativities and weaknesses are and to eliminate them. That's part of the polishing process. So Aladdin does that, and this genie, this remarkable power comes forth and it serves him. It brings him food, it brings him wealth. Food here represents good that comes from the divine. In a certain sense, this is a benevolent spirit as far as Aladdin is concerned, and it protects him. This is a wondrous story of hidden wisdom, of techniques of working upon ourselves. Look again at some of the fairy tales that you know, at some of the fairy tales perhaps some of your children or grandchildren are reading. You'll find extraordinary things hidden away, because this wisdom which the divine has sown into the world in all ages reaches us in very devious ways. Wisdom is hidden all around us in a multiplicity of forms, and we must seek it out. Sometimes there are treasures right in our very grasp and we fail to see them. We may say to ourselves, well, how is it that all these high truths are given to us mainly in the form of correspondences? Why does not the Lord God in his loving wisdom speak to us directly in our own language and explain to us in our own terms what life is all about? Then we'll understand, then we'll do something. Well, let's view it from this viewpoint. Have you ever had a conversation with an earthworm, a grasshopper, or an ant? Have you spoken to it, posed questions to it, and given it instructions? If you've given it instructions, has it obeyed you? Of course not, because the ant, the grasshopper, or the worm doesn't understand any of your language. It doesn't understand your indications. Now, in a certain sense, we are the ants and the grasshoppers and the worms with regard to the tremendous wisdom of God. We are just little particles with very few capacities indeed. The divine is talking to us all the time, is trying to make known the whole purpose of life, existence, the universe itself, and our role in it. But like the ants, we don't understand. Therefore, the divine has to devise ways and means of reaching us more indirectly through the shapes and things and patterns and functions of what we're familiar with in the world. That's the language of correspondences. The divine instructs us through the pattern of things, through sacred books that contain representations of those very homely things we're familiar with. All the parables of Christ were in familiar terms. Consider the lilies in the field, and that sort of thing. By looking around, we have a three-dimensional Bible around us. To learn something of the language of correspondences takes us into a new insight. Everything springs to life in a wonderful new way. But the incredible part is, through those correspondences, we begin to catch a glimpse of the way the divine is actively striving to reach us, to give us its all. And that is love, to give your all to something else, especially somebody or something that is, for the most part, ungrateful or unheeding. To give your all, that is pure love itself. And we are surrounded on all sides. Indeed, our very body is filled with its organs and tissues with correspondences. Our task is to learn to read this language. And Swedenborg is the great instrument whereby we can come into an understanding of this language of correspondences. It opens up so much for us. And any person who is really interested in the aim, meaning, and sense of existence, if they have that real passion, they cannot afford to ignore the science of correspondences. Thank you. Mm-hmm.